a long list of bills before us today. I would say that unless the sponsors sense opposition, it would be helpful to the committee if the supportive remarks be rather brief. So, because this is the last opportunity for the Revenue Committee to meet until we're authorized to meet again. So, with that, we'll have open up a public hearing on House Bill 3157. The Honorable Victor Backlund.
Chair Miller, I've been called a lot of things in the past, but honorable was never one of them, so I appreciate that very much. Chair Miller and members of the committee, I am Vic Back, and I'm a representative from North Salem and Kaiser, and I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 3157. This bill is a result of a constituent appeal to my office at the beginning of the session. That constituent, Daryl Goldstrom, asked if there was any possibility of providing some assistance to those people who go through the private adoption process. Since that time, we have had numerous contacts from other adopted parents making the same request. The expenses incurred by those who go through private adoption are considerable, ranging from approximately $9,000 up to as much as $17,000 or $18,000, depending upon which agency the adopting parents choose to go through. There is currently there is a $5,000 federal tax credit to help those adoptive parents, but Oregon, as of now, provides no assistance at all. House Bill 3157 will take a major step in giving additional support by providing a state tax credit of $1,500. This bill received an 8-0 vote in the House Revenue Committee after hearing testimony from six different parents who have adopted children from Cambodia, China, and Korea. Each of them encountered the extensive costs that I mentioned previously. House Bill 3157 received a 57-0 vote in the House and had no opposing testimony in committee or on the floor. So it is apparent to me, as it was to the members of the House Revenue Committee, that this legislation is warranted and is important. Some statistics that are kind of interesting. During the fiscal year of July 1, 1997 to June 30, 1998, 1,775 adoption petitions were filed in Oregon. Of that total, 244 were private agency adoptions. Now, we have discovered that children adopted through the Oregon Services to Children and Families or step-parent adoptions have virtually no revenue impact at all. So this bill pertains to private adoptions, primarily, again, because of the expense. So we feel this bill is justified, and I think this bill gives the state an opportunity to help some of our constituents in Oregon who are wanting to make a very positive impact on the lives of others by becoming adoptive parents. So to sum this up, I do urge your support for House Bill 3157.
Well, we thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Appreciate your bringing this bill to our attention.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
We have June Hickerson and Renee Kallstrom are signed up.
Chair Miller, members of the committee, my name is Renee Falstrom. I live at 2060 21st Street here in Salem. This is my daughter, Emily. On May 2nd, our family celebrated our third family day. We celebrated that Emily had joined us 3 years ago. During that time, this little girl has brought us more happiness and more joy and more adventure than we ever imagined was possible. Emily spent her first 18 months of life in a Russian orphanage. When we brought her home, she was a year and a half old. She weighed 17 pounds. Her feet were so small that I couldn't find shoes to fit her. Within 9 months, no one could ever tell that she had been undernourished or underdeveloped. There are literally hundreds of thousands of children in the world's orphanage and foster care systems that simply need parents to love them, families belong to and homes to live in. There are many, many Oregonians who would love to be their parents, who would love to bring these kids into their hearts, into their lives, but the initial cost of adoption is just too much. My husband and I were very fortunate. We had the financial means to make this happen. Many do, but many don't. I know that there are many measures before you this session that have a lot of well-intentioned purposes. And I know that these tax credits deplete the resources that we have for the rest of Oregon. However, this measure, I know and I can assure you, will improve, not only improve these children's lives, but in many cases it will save them. I urge your support for this measure, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. All right.
She's home napping with Daddy right now, I hope. My name is June Hickerson, and I also live within blocks of the Capitol building here. And I want to share with you about how our family came together. My daughter was born in China in August of 1997. Roughly that same time, my husband and I coincidentally began the adoption process here in Oregon. And that involved all the usual things that people go through, the documentation, the counseling, all the ups and downs and emotions that everybody goes through. It also included an adoption agency fee of $125, home study and placement fees of post-placement fees of $950. This is for the services of a social worker. Agency program fee of $3,500. An INS fee for filing our pre-approval. $155. The fee for authenticating and translating and sending our dossier to the People's Republic, which was $565. Travel expenses, roughly $5,000. A standard orphanage donation, which is used well over there, which is $3,000, and in-country legal expenses and miscellaneous fees of $1,400. All of this brought the cost of bringing Maddie home to about $15,000. When this was all taken care of, and after an 18-month wait, followed by a 26 hours of travel, which was longer than the 18 months, my husband and I walked into a hotel room in Nanchang, China on March 23rd of this year, not quite 2 months ago. We were handed a 14-pound bundle of a little girl who was going to change our world as much as we were going to change hers. We are now a family, and we consider ourselves very fortunate to have Maddie in our life. Obviously, this proposed bill is going to help the Hickersons and other families like us who have adopted recently, but I see the biggest benefit going to those people who are wanting to adopt and cannot financially afford it, as well as those children in the state of Oregon and internationally that are looking for homes.
Okay.
This bill could make a difference for them the same way health insurance makes a difference for people in covering prenatal expenses. I recently received a letter from a former coworker that congratulated us on Maddie's arrival, and she told me that she and her husband were unable to have children and were not going to be able to adopt due to the expense, and I would really love to write her and let her know that the state of Oregon has a plan to help make the adoption happen for them. Thank you.
All right. Are there questions?
Questions?
Thank you for your testimony. Emily, thank you. Thanks for coming.
Chairman, would you accept the motion?
We have one other witness. If she wants to make a brief statement, we would permit that. Otherwise, we're probably prepared to act favorably on the bill. I guess. We don't want to deny you.
Don't be like Tom.
You have your letter.
Yeah.
I do it in the file, and
okay.
You all do.
Good. My name's Emily Breeden. I went to China to adopt my daughter Katie in July of 1995. I don't need to tell those of you who are parents what a blessing and a joy she has been to me.
You do.
Becoming a parent has enriched my life immeasurably, and because I'm not married, I would not have become a parent had it not been for adoption. I worked for an international adoption agency in McMinnville, and the total fees came to nearly $12,000. I was fortunate enough to be able to take out a loan for that full amount, but that's a loan that I'll be paying off until my daughter's 15 years old. I know not every family is able or willing to make such a financial risk at the beginning of the forming of their family. Almost immediately after Katie and I became a family, I started dreaming about the day I'd be able to go back to China and adopt a second daughter. I'm still hoping to make that dream come true. The only thing standing in my way is lack of funds. The passage of House Bill 3157 could bring Katie the baby sister she's been begging for. I'm asking you to support this bill not just for the sake of my family and for these families, but for the sake of all the little children in the world who are so desperately needing families and for all the families who are waiting eagerly to take them home. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness? If not, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3157? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3157. Open a work session on House Bill 3157. Vice Chair Wilde.
Mr. Chair, I'd move HB 3157A to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde moves House Bill 3157 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Fire.
Aye.
Senator Hartung.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Wilde.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 3157 is passed to the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3157.
Senator Fair,
who's trying to?
I'm looking.
Senator
Beyer.
We got
Beyer. We'll carry the bill. Yep. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Backlund.
Lots of volunteers for that one.
Is that right? I have a conflict of interest, so I don't know what it is.
I mean, it's everything.
Be clear.
All right. We'll now move to a public hearing on House Bill 2129.
Work session.
Excuse me? Work session. That's what I meant to say. We'll move to a work session on House Bill 2129.
Oh,
Liz Beth is here.
What number was that?
2129A. You are dying to hear.
All right, Liz Beth.
Okay.
Is that good?
Chairman Miller and members of the committee, you just heard House Bill 2129 earlier this week, but there was a conflict with another bill, so we have a new amendment. It's the -A17. It rolls up all the ones that we passed when we had the public hearing work session last time, and then it eliminates those conflicts. Now, just so you're aware, too, we didn't get a chance to talk about the A14. And on the revenue impact, I do have that written up for you. So if you do have any questions about this, as far as what the revenue impact is from that amendment dealing with the historical property, it basically is depending on the court case that Mr. DiLorenzo referred to and whether or not is it appealed or not. And so that's basically what revenue impact is going through. Are you guys... Okay. Everybody have the
-A17? 17. What's this? I don't think I have that. The A17. How are the rest of the committee on the A17?
I have the other one.
Are you all finding your A17?
Yes.
Well, that's before I take it you aren't.
You've got a little ways to go.
You want to very thick.
Yeah, very.
I wasn't the only one that's been trying.
No.
Sort of like playing bingo.
There. Hey. Got it.
Thank you.
All right. We're in work session on House Bill 2129. We have the A17.
Would you like a motion,
Mr. Chair?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wild moves the dash 17 amendments to House Bill 2129.
I think you have to resend your vote.
Oh. Maybe we should.
Yeah.
Did
you voted it out?
Oh.
So the chair would move that we resend the vote by which we passed House Bill 2129. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is to order. The bill is before us. We have before us now House Bill 2129. Vice Chair Wild moves the dash 17 amendments to House Bill 2129. For discussion?
Just to be clear, what is different than the 817?
No, there is just a conflict at the council. They will go through and check with various other bills that are going through at the same time.
After the conflict?
Yeah, something to do with accounting versus accountants. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all rolled up correctly in here.
You and them. Is there further discussion on the amendments? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Wild moves House Bill 2129 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
All good.
Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hartung. Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wild. Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 2129. Pass to the floor. We'll close the work session. I'll show 2-1. And we thank Senator Wild.
Fine.
Senator Byer.
Yeah, he was just dying to get this one.
All right. Thank you, Senator Byer. I appreciate that. We'll now move to House Bill 2079.
You did a good job.
Thanks a lot.
Now
I've got to figure
out. You've only got 17. You're up for a while, Mr. Waters. We're opening up a public hearing. And I'm still 2079. Elizabeth?
All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what you have before you in House Bill 2079 is a dash A3. And just to recall your memory, what this bill is doing is it's giving a property tax exemption for long-term care facilities. And this dash A3 is also incorporating in foster homes. And with the long-term care facilities, they have to have an average residency rate of 70%. And for the adult foster homes, they have to have an average residency rate of 60% or more who are eligible for Medicaid. So both the real and the personal property will be exempt from the long-term care facilities, and this will include nursing facilities, assisted living, or residential care facilities, all that meet this criteria of 70% or more of the eligible residents having eligible for Medicaid. The owner of the long-term care facility will apply to the Senior and Disabled Services Division for certification of the facility. And the exemption will apply if the governing body of the local taxing district adopts this property tax exemption by ordinance. So this is a local option alternative that local districts can decide by ordinance whether or not they want to give this property tax exemption for adult foster homes and long-term care facilities. This applies on or after July 1st of 2000. And so the revenue impact, since this is an option that local districts have this to approve themselves, it's something that I can't really give any type of firm revenue impact, but just so you're aware of, I gave you various numbers of how many different facilities would qualify. And roughly, with a survey in January of 1999, of the nursing care facilities, there were possibly 50 that would qualify, meaning that 70% or more of the residents are eligible for Medicaid. And then we looked at various average property taxes that were paid by a sample of nursing facilities in 1997-98. That was roughly about $18,000. And the number of eligible nursing facilities is estimated to grow approximately about 4% a year. And with the assisted living facilities and the residential care facilities, in another Oregon Healthcare Association survey, they found that currently, there's not very many of the assisted living facilities that would qualify, only about 5 out of 105, and that's only about 5%. And then with residential care facilities, only about 33% would actually qualify for this property tax exemption. But again, this is something that is a local option, and with the adult foster homes, there's only about 483 homes, or 33% of the total homes that would actually qualify, according to SDSC data, as of December of 98.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. We do have three witnesses signed up for this bill, Gwen Dayton, Wilbur Simmons, Lynn McNamara. You'd all like to come forward and I know two have signed up in favor of this bill, and McNamara wants to come and shed light on
Chair Miller, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton with the Oregon Healthcare Association, speaking in support of House Bill 2079. I will make my remarks brief in the interest of time. We're here on this bill because it represents one way to help preserve the financial viability of long-term care facilities that rely heavily on Medicaid for their reimbursement. Medicaid traditionally has not paid the full cost to provide health care. And that problem has only grown worse with the increase in the minimum wage in Oregon. 70% of long-term care facilities' fixed costs are labor, and they've gone up by between 12 and 15% in the last year. And Medicaid reimbursement rates have not begun to keep pace. And in fact, the recommended increase for this next biennium is only 2% per year. So when a facility relies on at least 70%, and in many cases more than 70%, of their revenue stream, when they rely on Medicaid for 70% of that or more, they are facing great strain in meeting their costs. And unlike others who are also impacted by increasing costs, they can't raise the price of their services. Their rates are by and large set by the state, and those few private pay residents who increase their rate, they simply spend down to Medicaid even faster, so it's not a long-term solution to the increase in costs that they're facing. And our concern with this is not only financial viability of a business, but even more importantly, really, access to care for the frail, elderly, and disabled in our state. Because long-term care is unique in the sense that it not only provides health care, but it also provides a place for people to live. And people want to stay in their communities. They want to stay near their family, their church, their social supports when they move to long-term care. And our concern is that if facilities either go under or they decide not to take Medicaid any longer because they can't afford it, people will be forced to go to other communities in order to receive long-term health care. And we simply don't want to see that happen. This bill is modeled after an existing statute that provides a property tax exemption for low-income housing. This is structured exactly the same way as that exemption, and we're similar to them in the sense that we not only provide health care, but also provide, as I said, a place to live. Much of the opposition, to the extent there was any in the House side, has been resolved by the local option that is now attached to this bill, so it doesn't apply to any local entities, county, city, or other taxing district, unless that taxing district expressly adopts it. And just by way of example on how this bill would work, we have a member that was approached by a local chamber of commerce and asked to build a long-term care facility, but it would have been a high Medicaid census area, and he simply couldn't make it pencil out. The money wasn't there, given the revenue stream. And he had to say no. He just couldn't afford to. And that person would then go, if this passes, will go to the county and the city and the taxing districts and plead his case. And in that area, it'll probably be worth it for them because they feel that it's a long-term care facility and they will likely grant them this exemption. In other areas, maybe it won't make sense, but that's the beauty of this. It can be resolved individually by the taxing districts. With that, I will stop and ask you if you have any questions.
Oh, we'll hear from Mr. Simmons.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Grover Simmons, representing the adult foster home industry, and thank you for hearing this Dashery amendment. My remarks really are just supplementary to Gwen's, respectfully asking you to accept the amendment and act favorably on the basic bill. The reason that adult foster homes are requesting 60% instead of 70% as the Medicaid eligible standard is that if we were held to a 70% standard, that would require 4 out of 5 residents in a foster home being Medicaid, and it would be very difficult to stay open and make a living if you had that many Medicaid in these very, very small facilities, small homes. I was interested in the staff report indicating that 483 homes would potentially be eligible. That's out of somewhere between 1,950 and 2,000 homes. I really didn't know how many might qualify as an essential community provider, so I was interested in getting that number as well. We, the foster home part of the industry, sign on to the local option, and it's my understanding that the nursing home has association has no objection to the adult foster homes being added to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you both. Lynn McNamara.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. We really want to be on the record because we opposed this bill when it first appeared in the House because it did not include a local option. It was simply an exemption of property taxes, and we appreciate the proponents changing the bill to have a local option. We think that makes a lot more sense for a community to make its own decision. And as the statement said, communities may indeed choose to do that. The addition of adult foster homes may make it more difficult for a community to make that decision because the revenue impact will likely be greater, but we do not oppose that at all. I think what I'd really like to note is that it's unfortunate that Medicaid reimbursement is insufficient to make these facilities viable, and so that local communities are being asked to make up the difference. But again, we don't oppose the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Other questions?
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2079? Now we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2079. Open a work session. House Bill 2079. We have the dash A3s before us. Senator Wilde.
I think I shall move those.
Senator Wilde moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2079. For discussion of the amendment. Objection. Hearing and seeing none, they are agreed to. Senator Wilde.
I move HB 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde moves House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Hearing and seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Hartung.
Aye.
Chair
Wilde.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 2079 is passed to the floor. Closed work session on House Bill 2079. Senator Stark, thank you very much. We'll now move to a public hearing on House Bill 2124. Thank you, Lizbeth.
Thank you.
Take the rest of the day off. No, you're back. You're coming back.
No,
I can have you later.
Can take the rest of the day off.
Mr. Yates. Aren't you coming? Oh, it's hers. You switched.
Oh, that was a long time away.
2124?
Oh, okay.
Glad to have you back. All right.
Okay. Chairman Miller, members of the committee, we've heard House Bill 2124, and now you have a dash A3 before you.
Mm.
And what A3 is doing is, I'll just refresh your memory, this measure is extending the personal property tax penalty to individuals who fail to file a personal property tax return at all. Okay, this was a mistake that was left out when the personal property tax penalty was changed in the 97 session. This measure also has a clause that once a taxpayer files an application and can show that they have a good and sufficient reason for filing late, the County Board of Property Tax Appeals can waive now, with this amendment, they can waive all or a portion of the penalty. So this measure is just clarifying in both the appeals criteria language for real property and personal property, so that there's consistency between the two statutes, 308-295 and 308-296, that all or a portion of that penalty can be waived. It shall be entered on the tax roll as an error correction, and it begins on or after July 1st of 1999.
Thank you. Mr. Maneri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I'll just say, in terms of the one portion of this bill dealing with the Board of Property Tax Appeals, current law imposes a penalty structure for businesses late filing their returns, personal property returns. Current law does not provide a remedy for them if they think the penalty is too harsh. They have nowhere to go under current law. This provides that the County Board of Tax Appeals can hear that and waive the penalty. And as Senator Wild pointed out at the earlier hearing, the current provisions only allow the board to waive either all of it or none of it. The amendments give the board the flexibility to hear the case and waive all or part of it. So it's a lot more flexibility.
Other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2124? Now we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2124. We'll open a work session. House Bill 2124. Mr. Wild.
I will move the A3 amendment to House Bill 2124.
Mr. Wild moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2124. For discussion of the amendment. Your objection. Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Wild.
I move HB 2124 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Wild moves House Bill 2124 as amended to the floor. They do pass recommendation. Discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator Harsha.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wild.
Aye.
Close aye. House Bill 2124 is passed to the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2124. Thank you, Mr. Wild, for carrying that bill and for the improvements that we think he made. All right. Thank you again.
All right. You don't have enough.
Very bad. Now, we'll move to a public hearing on House Bill 2190. Bill 2190. Mr. Miner, Mr. Elkins, Mr. Tyler, Mr. Hess, y'all here? Not Mr. Miner. Bull.
2190.
Sure.
Quick, Chair.
Just quick. I don't believe my name.
Bull is L E L K I N.
Welcome. Do you want to lead off, or do you think they can do it?
Whatever is your pleasure.
Yeah. I'll get in the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Bowen. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. And I believe you have before you some dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2190. These were developed in consultation with the Department of Transportation Motor Fuel Tax Branch, and we think that they reflect a better approach. That they reflect a better approach to the bonding issue for the licensed fuel dealers, most of which are distributors.
Just a second, man. We're looking for the A5.
I don't have any.
Yeah.
Maybe while you're waiting, it would be a good idea to go through the bill before we start talking about it.
Yeah.
No,
I'm not trying to do that.
Mr. Chair, the first part of the bill addresses the question of collection of fuel taxes on gasoline. The situation currently is that the department has access through the Attorney General, but it's not worked out particularly well, with the result that they essentially contract with the Department of Revenue for the collection of gasoline fuel tax taxes that are not paid. And what the first part of the bill does is to give incorporate statutes patterned after the ones that the department uses in connection with the weight mile tax for the collection of those taxes, and make them applicable to the gasoline or motor vehicle fuel tax. And so that's what the first part of the bill is doing. It takes out some of the language that refers to the Attorney General, for example, on page 2, line 37, with respect to penalty and interest. On page 3, with respect to line 16, it's taking out, again, a person fails to pay the license tax. So it's deleting those old provisions and instituting new provisions for the collection tax, which are patterned after the existing ones for the weight mile tax. Section 12, then, on page 4, changes the bonding requirements, and this is this section of the amendment's address. On line 35, you have the factor there, if you like, for a licensee. The bond has to be twice the estimated monthly tax is going to be paid. The bill increases that to 4 times and then takes the maximum bond on line 37 to $1 million. Okay. In section 13, we're dealing with diesel fuel now rather than gasoline, and dealing with a particular problem which has to do with card locks and associations or groups of people which are using, when they get together, they can meet the minimum 2,400 gallons per month that have to be consumed to operate through the card lock. The nature of the card lock distributor is that they don't meet the standard of the seller because there's no one on duty, so they don't have to collect the diesel fuel tax. This means that burden is transferred to the user, and the user should get a user fuel tax license and pay the tax on the fuel they're consuming. Well, turns out a lot of people have been unaware that the tax was not included in the price they were paying through these operations, and when they're discovered, they owe quite a bit of back tax and penalty and interest and so on, and this provision tries to tighten that up so that this will not be a problem in the future, and to take care of the people that are out there that are sort of hanging loose.
We're hanging loose. Other than loose.
Yeah. Then the last section dealing with licensing, again, is giving the department the authority to revoke licenses. And, again, it deals with duplicated itself, if you're looking at it. In section 17, you're dealing with gasoline taxes, and in section 20, with diesel fuel taxes.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, now that we're all on the same page, the Dash A5 amendments that you have in front of you reflect the petroleum marketers' concerns that the $1 million bond requirement that would be required under the version of House Bill 2190 that you have in front of you would increase the annual bonding costs for distributors who carry this license by anywhere from $4,000 to $5,000. We felt that for most of these companies who have faithfully performed the requirements and remitted their taxes in a timely fashion, that this was exorbitant and unnecessary. I contacted the department, and we had some discussions about establishing some grandfathering provisions for those licensed dealers who had faithfully performed for past years. The language in front of you reflects that. We also capped the total amount of the bond from $1 million to $250,000 to just reflect basically what we thought was a more reasonable top-end liability. that they should be required to be bonded for. The amendments reflect that on page 2, line 23, that a person who on the effective date of this act holds a valid dealer license need not obtain a new bond if they have faithfully performed under the existing requirements for the previous 3 years. Basically, the intent behind that, again, is so that they would not have to, those who have been good actors under the existing statute would not have to obtain a new bond. There is also provisions at the top of that same page for persons who have not been timely in their payments, that they would be could be subject to the higher bond bonding amount, but would be able to present evidence if there was mitigating circumstances as to why there was a reasonable cause why they had not been able to perform in a timely fashion. So we think they're good amendments to the bill. They make it much more livable and workable for us, and would urge your adoption.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dave Tyler, Chief Financial Officer for ODOT. With me is Quentin Hess, the Fuel Tax Group Manager. Very much appreciate Mr. Bowe's excellent summarization of the bill. The issue we are discussing in terms of bonding levels is essentially a question of risk and exposure. How much exposure is the state willing to take on in the event of default? The current bonding levels have been there for many, many years. Gas taxes have increased significantly. Distributors' liabilities have increased significantly. This is a consensus amendment, if you will, with industry. We're willing to work with them. We're still concerned about the risk. We believe very strongly this is a much better position for the department to be in at this point in time. And if there are further concerns, I think we have industry's assurance that they will work with us to come back in a couple of years and revisit the maximum bonding levels. We're very comfortable with this, would urge your support, and appreciate very much your taking the time today to hear this bill.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Other questions? Thank you all. Representative Logan, would you...
I have added a question to this bill, and could speak to that if you so desire. If you're comfortable with it as it is.
We're always glad to have your comments.
All right. Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. I submitted amendments on the House side, which are included in Section 13 sub 2 and 13A on behalf of my constituents, Don and Kathy Duvall, and as well as 11 other Milwaukee families. Incidentally, for the record, I am Representative Logan, District 25. And this problem also involved other Oregon families. In fact, there were 175 other Oregon families that were impacted by this case. And what happened was that these families joined the Richmark Oil and Gas Group in 1998 to purchase discounted gasoline and diesel fuel, and they pumped them, the gas and diesels themselves, at facilities owned by Weiss Oil Company. And they had made very extensive inquiries about this marketing endeavor, and they were assured that this was, they checked the Better Business Bureau of both Oregon and Washington, where this company was located, and they assured them that this was a good company. They had nothing to discourage them from becoming part of this group, and they were assured that the fuel taxes were included in the price at the pump. But lo and behold, in March 1999, they received their bill, and they were billed not only for the 24-cent Oregon state fuel tax, but also for a 25% penalty because they had not paid their fuel tax. So they inquired, and the upshot of that, they came to me about it. They said they're very willing to pay the fuel tax, but it amounted to quite a bit, the penalty. They felt that was wrong, since they had been assured that they did not have to pay the fuel tax separately. And I talked to ODOT about it, and this is the way that ODOT was willing to settle it. So it is a part of this bill, and I urge your consideration and approval of that part of the bill that will help my constituents. I feel it's a good, fair thing, and I really, really, it's a good way to settle that problem, and to, I certainly compliment ODOT as well for being willing to provide that.
Thank you. Are there questions? I had identified you as Representative Logan. It's Loken, isn't it? Thank you.
I'm going to send you a card so you will know.
Thank you very much.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, it is.
Don Meyer, Al Elkins.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in favor of the Dash 4 amendments to 2190A growth. Those amendments would shorten the statute of limitations for folks who use fuel tax to 1 year instead of the normal 6 years, which is being applied currently. This limitation would only apply to drivers who transport manufactured houses or operate tow trucks, and would only apply to the year 1980, 98, and before. In addition, in order to fall under this exemption, that driver must have complied with the weight mile tax reporting, his obligations, and the IFTA tax obligations. Our industry was unaware of the used fuel tax. In fact, I only learned of it in January. When I began getting calls from drivers who were being notified by ODOT that there may be an outstanding obligation, my testimony includes an attachment. There's a copy of that letter that they received. We've also attached to that a copy of the typical weight mile tax report. If you'll look at that, you'll see that it covers both loaded and unloaded miles, and imposes a tax on loaded miles. When it deals with the unloaded miles, the word EXEMP is printed on that form. It's my understanding that the form comes with that language on it from ODOT. Drivers had assumed that, at least it's my understanding, that our drivers had assumed that the tax on the unloaded miles was rolled into the tax on the loaded miles. Probably not a very good assumption, but nevertheless, I think it was an honest assumption. I've also enclosed a copy of the IFTA tax return. You'll notice on that it reports the total miles driven, as well as the total gallons of fuel that are used. Now, and finally, I've given you a used fuel tax report. That tax is based essentially on a per gallon tax. Now, all of these reports are submitted to ODOT. Unfortunately, well, it's our belief that we submitted the correct information to ODOT, but not on the correct form. ODOT could have known that these drivers were not properly paying the tax, but this went unnoticed for a long time. But the information that we submitted could have been used to correctly calculate the tax and to identify folks who owed this tax. But it was not done. Both ourselves and ODOT appear to have missed this. Now, normally, the statute of limitations would have been 3 years, but that does not cover these drivers because a statute does not apply in those cases where a person neglected to file a report. Of course, in this case, they were unaware of the reporting obligation and neglected. Therefore, ODOT is using a 6-year statute of limitation. This is presenting a very severe hardship on these operators. They don't have the ability to pass this tax on, at least the back tax. Going forward, they'll, I'm sure, increase their rates and pass it on. But they really don't have an ability to pass this tax on now. Had this mistake been caught earlier, the problem wouldn't have arisen and we wouldn't be before you.
Thank you. We're going to pick up the pace here a little bit.
Okay, Chair, Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. I can only echo the same sentiments that Mr. Miner has spoken to. I did a survey of the people that called me since January. I've talked to 4 so far. I asked them what taxes they pay now that they know about for each of their trucks. They pay the weight mile. They pay overweight permits. They pay their licenses. They pay what they call an ESIL tax for over 80,000 pounds, and they pay a road use assessment tax. The 4 that I have surveyed did not know of this. They've been in business for 31 years, 25 years, 23 years, and 9 years. And I've asked them what they have learned from this experience, and they have learned a lot of confusion. Doesn't seem to be any clear direction as to what they should pay under this tax or what they shouldn't pay. So we ask that you adopt this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wild, you had a question?
Yes, yes. I'd like to discuss on page 1, section 2, sub 1, because with your situation of someone who was unaware that they had to pay, if this were to go into effect, and there's a similar section on page 3, I think it's section 12, or section 9. I mean, if a person fails to pay in full any tax, interest, or penalty due, blah, 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 may issue a warrant upon the department's official seal directed to the sheriff of any county of the state commanding the sheriff to levy upon and sell the real and personal property of the person found within the county for payment of the amount due with the added penalties or charges, interest, and the cost of executing the warrant, and to return the warrant to the department and pay to the department the money collected from the sale by the time specified in the warrant, not less than 6 days from the date of the warrant. Now, that's pretty heavy duty. Some would argue that's not incredible due process either. How do you feel about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, in the case where a person didn't even know he owed the tax, it does seem to be stringent form of the tax.
Sounds kind of like Soviet Union to me.
Now, our amendment would not impact that provision, except to say that they could only go back 1 year for those years prior to 1998.
Kind of rough to find out you owe something as you're getting something sold at a sheriff's sale, though. I know it does have to be posted generally prior to selling it at a sheriff's sale, but it wouldn't make anyone's day being treated in that manner. I think this is horrible. It's just horrible.
Thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to testify in opposition to House Bill 2190 in opposition? Not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2190. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2190. Chair would move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2190. Is there objection to dash 4 amendments? Not, the amendments are agreed to. Move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2190. Objection to the dash 5s. Hearing and seeing none, the dash 5s are agreed to. Chair would move House Bill 2190 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Their discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Harrison.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wild.
No.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 2190 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2190. Senator Wild, this means you will not be carrying that bill?
I would guess not, although it would be fun.
I'd like to thank Senator Hartman.
Oh, you're going to be... Oh, that will be...
All right, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2811.
Resistance to 2811.
2811.
Mr. Don Heffner, why don't you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board. We're in strong support of House Bill 2811. This was introduced at the request of the Oregon Parks Association. They're a major beneficiary of boating facility projects, which is funded from motorboat fuel tax. The transfer of motorboat gas tax to the Marine Board for boating programs was authorized in 1985. The method of estimating that tax was left to the Department of Administrative Services in consultation with ODOT and the Marine Board. In the early years of 85 and 86, it was done through a survey method through Oregon State University. In 1987, that changed, and we started using the U.S. Treasury method to estimate the gas tax. Last April, several concerns were identified regarding that Treasury method. First, the fact that it was national and not Oregon-only data that was used for it, and the fact that it hadn't been updated since the early 80s. Based on those discussions, we agreed to return to the survey method, and House Bill 2811 provides the institutional framework for future surveys. It establishes the survey method as a way to estimate the fuel tax in the future. It provides for certainty, lets all the agencies involved know how future estimates will be developed, provides that an independent survey will be done once every 4 years, update the estimate beginning with the survey which was just completed by Oregon State University this spring. The bill is important because the revenue forecast for a 1999-01 budget is based on that survey, and that's why the bill has an emergency clause. Our budget has passed the Senate 30-0 and is pending on the House floor. This bill was heard in the Senate Transportation Committee earlier this week. Given a due pass recommendation, we would urge your support for the bill.
Are there questions? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2811? If not, close the public hearing on House Bill 2811. We'll open a work session. House Bill 2811. Recognize Senator Wilde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 2811 to the floor of the due pass.
Senator Wilde moves House Bill 2811 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator
Aye.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator
Hirschman?
Aye.
Senator Miller?
Aye. Votes aye. House Bill 2811 passed the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2811.
Oh.
Chair of volunteers.
Voting.
That's right, yeah, that's big in my ear.
Sure. Is there the chair, is that funny?
All right, we'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 3405. Mr. Waters is heading back, and we have no one has signed up on 3405.
Okay.
Oh, all right. You're from Representative Jensen's office, and you'd like to testify? I'd be glad to have your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kristen Rifford, and I'm legislative assistant to Representative Jensen, and I'm sorry you can't be here today, but I testify on his behalf. I'm going to speak to the -A4 amendment. HB 3405 allows a subtraction against personal income tax, a corporate tax, noted for donation of land to educational institutions. And Representative Jensen, after talking to the sponsor of the bill, believed that it was not the original intent to include educational institutions that are for-profit under this subtraction. So the -4 amendment eliminates this tax benefit for for-profit educational institutions. And we did talk to Representative Strobeck, and he does support this change. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3405? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3405. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3405. Dash 4 amendments would remove the private for-profit educational institutions from this benefit. That's correct, Mr. Waters?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Well, private not for-profit, if there is such a thing.
Well?
Most private schools are not for-profit.
Oh. But we're just eliminating private.
That's right. If they're non-institutions and not-for-profits, they would still be eligible to receive the donations under...
Oh, the 501c3?
That's right.
Okay. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parker.
So this applies to Phoenix University? University of Phoenix?
Right. Amendment? They would remove them?
They would be moved out.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if they're for-profit.
What other institutions, private or profit, do we have?
I don't know.
I'm not aware of any.
Well, it's up to the committee as to whether or not to approve the dashboards. If no one moves them, then we'll, I would be prepared to move on to 3405 as it's before us.
Yes. Yeah. I'd move the dash 4 amendments.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3405. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Not the chair objects.
Oh. They sort of thought.
Chair without any influence on the rest of the committee. Not a new phenomenon. All right, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Starr moves House Bill 3405 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Hartung?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wiles?
Aye.
Chair Miller?
Votes aye. House Bill 3405 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3405. Senator Starr for his willingness to carry this bill. Okay. We'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 3600. Mr. Waters.
Hey, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3600 establishes individual development accounts programs for lower-income households. It defines general eligibility requirements for those opening these accounts. Directs the Housing and Community Services Department to administer the program. And sets out other terms and conditions of the program.
All right. Thank you. I would advise the witnesses that there is no one signed up in opposition to this bill. Please introduce yourselves and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Foster, and I have with me Tracy Leto, Strickland. In the interest of time, we're basically waiting for Representative Merkley to get here and make his comments. He's arrived.
Yes.
Holding the fort for you.
We think the left was recording enough. How about this?
This is so entertaining.
Are we on? We're on.
Mr. Chair and members of the Senate, thank you for hearing House Bill 3600 today. This bill presents a different strategy for working with low-income families in Oregon. Most of our state programs and most federal programs take the strategy of what's called an income-based strategy, where you assist people in getting by month to month. This bill takes a very different approach called an equity strategy or an asset-based strategy. And the goal is to take and promote strategies that lift people out of being low-income families so that they are essentially out of poverty. And the way that it does that is a mechanism called an individual development account. And I should say, for the record, Representative Jeff Merkley, District 16 from Portland. And the mechanism is that as under one of these programs, these IDA programs, as a family saves a dollar who has chosen to participate, they earn credit towards a matching grant for either education, starting a business, or purchase of a home. One of the things this does is funds only get dispersed to families that are investing in their own future and trying to get out of poverty. And so it is a helping hand, not a handout. And that's a very important distinction. Now, a family may attempt to save money for several years, never succeed in saving the money they need for their down payment, and may exit the program. They wouldn't ever get a state dollar. The state dollar comes in to them at the point that they undertake to buy the house, start the business, or attend college. That's the guts of the idea, and I know your time is very brief and your agenda is long. I think it's a very useful strategy for us to undertake, and I encourage your support.
All right, we thank you. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair, I'll pass out. I have almost enough copies for all of you of the one IDA program that is operating, and both these folks have been quite involved in that and tell you more about it.
All right, we thank you for that.
I'm Tracy Lato. I work at Human Solutions, and I coordinate the IDA program at Human Solutions. I've been running the program for 2 years now. I'm available for questions if you have any.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
And as I indicated earlier, my name is David Foster. I've been interested in asset building strategies for about 10 years and also work at Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, which is the agency that is involved, is listed on the bill as being the responsible entity to distribute the tax credits. And so I wanted to make sure that I was available for any questions that you might have regarding the bill. In the interest of time, we've got plenty we could give you, but there's no opposition. I just defer to you in terms of what your preference is.
All right. Mr. Waters?
I have a quick question. How many of these accounts are there currently operating that you know of?
In Oregon?
In Oregon.
Currently, we at Human Solutions have 74 accounts open, and people have been joining the program, periodically since 97, and folks have accumulated $19,000 of their own funds at this point. And there are a few youth accounts open as well in Portland, about 15.
All right. Are there other questions? Thank you all for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3600? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3600. Open up a work session on House Bill 3600. Recognize Senator Wilde.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move HB 3600 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Very well. Move House Bill 3600 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hurtado.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator
Bennett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Miller. Aye. House Bill 3600 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session. House Bill 3600. Senator Wilde will carry. Thank you. We'll now move to a.
Couldn't do that. That's hard to talk. It should be hard.
Oh. You're taking a work through process, right? You think?
Yeah.
Let's get that.
Oh, he's
looking at his baseball cards.
He's got left.
Well, that's going to take a little time, and I'll make sure I get to the. Yeah, it's
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'll do
this. And then the spring when they can watch.
We'll now open up a work session on Senate Bill 537. Mr. Waters.
Senate Bill 537 increases the maximum personal income tax deduction allowed for federal income taxes from its current level of $3,000 to $5,000. For $10,000. The Dash 1 amendments, which have been prepared, which you should have, reduce that threshold from $10,000 in the original bill to $5,000. So the net effect of the Dash 1 amendments would be to increase the federal income tax subtraction limit from $3,000 to $5,000 and index that threshold to changes in the consumer price index beginning the 2001 tax year.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Waters. We had this discussion before, members, and you recall that limiting this exemption at any number is objectionable. However, we may have to begin making these moves to fairness in a
slovenly way.
Slovenly. So, I move. Yes, Senator Weil?
I'll move the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Weil moves the modest Dash 1 amendments to make the exemption $5,000 down from $10,000 in the bill. Is there a discussion of the amendment? Objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Weil?
I move SB 537 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Weil moves Senate Bill 537 to the floor with a due pass, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Beyer.
No.
Senator Hartung.
Oh, aye.
Senator Weil.
Aye.
Senator
Both sides. Senate Bill 537.
It's a slobbing.
Senate Bill 537 passed to the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 537. Senator Weil, I'm back to carry that. All right,
you can go out.
That'd be fine. You'll get some help.
Oh, yes. Come on.
We'll now move to a work session on Senate Bill 535. Mr. Waters.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 535, as you may recall from a couple of months ago, reduces the maximum personal income tax rate for capital gains to 4%. Currently, capital gains are taxed as ordinary income at either 5%, 7%, or 9% marginal rate, depending upon the taxable income level of the taxpayer. This bill also reduces the capital gains tax rates for corporations and applies those changes to tax years beginning January 1, 2000.
All right. Is there a discussion?
We're in work session?
Yeah. Senator Weil,
are we in work session?
We are in a work session.
You want this thing moved?
Or you want
to talk about it?
Well, I do, but I want to see about changing a couple of numbers.
Huh?
Date.
Kind of late in the game for that.
Ah,
do it. Conceptually?
Well, I think we can say that. In Section 3, I believe, of the bill as before us. Mr. Waters, if we made this apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2002, it would have zero impact in the
about that
in the 9901 biennium.
That's
That'd be correct.
That's approximately correct, Mr. Chair.
So even though it would delay fairness, it would hold the promise of fairness to those who might consider locating in Oregon as thinking this was the reasonable place to reside. That'd be right? Or that...
I don't know if you can just
I guess you're limited. Right. Just that thing about the 2002 would have no impact on 2001
finance.
No, that's just a yes or no.
Okay.
Chair would move on line 26, where it says January 1, 2000, that becomes January 1, 2002. Are discussions? Their objections? Hearing and seeing none. The amendment is agreed to. Chair would move. Senate Bill 535 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? If not, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator
Hurston?
Aye. Senator
Starr? Aye. Vice Chair Wild? Aye. Both aye. Senate Bill 535 is passed to the floor, as amended, passed to the floor. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 535.
And you get to carry that. That'd be fine.
I think they will.
It's a new form of expenditure cap.
Okay, now we'll go back into
order of
things here. It is after 4:15. Chair would we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2947. Mm-hmm. You're doing it. 2947 appears to be, after discussion with Legislative Council, the vehicle, as they say, to actually combine the thoughts that we've been discussing at some length on Senate Bills 1, 2, 6, and 4, 6, 4. Mr. Johnson here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Mr. Waters. You're in on that. You understand what Mr. Johnson had to say and the relating clause and all that stuff? Here he comes. Mr. Johnson. For some reason, 2947. Mr. Johnson, I was just telling the committee that on 2947, that seems to be an appropriate vehicle to incorporate the thoughts contained within Senate Bill 126 where is it? 464 that we were discussing yesterday.
Mr. Chair, yes, 2947 is a relating clause relating to taxation, and those provisions would be appropriate to put in 2947.
All right. Now, yesterday, you may recall, we had a discussion about these Revenue Code 170 charitable deductions. It was kind of a little credit for
the umbrella
for all those who couldn't think of a specified credit. So there were, I know Senator Starr was had thoughts.
Yeah, the bill.
It's getting replaced. Stuff.
And I also brought up that minor matter yesterday of the political tax credit.
Minor matter.
Is that in here?
The chair's desire to jettison that from the tax code.
Did we work that in here?
And yep. Save the taxpayers of Oregon. First. I hear people talking about needs for schools and so forth. $8 million contribution to worthy causes.
Wow. I know who's carrying this.
I'd be happy to do that.
Let's move the amendment.
Okay. So I just want to have the committee, and I know that, you know, one of those is maybe not universally adored.
Yeah, listen.
So I'm willing to hear what the committee has to say about it. The chair, well, let me move the dash 6. The House Bill 2947, and I will listen to the committee with respect to amendments of that proposal if you so choose.
Yeah, it looks fine.
I don't like them, but...
Sure. I would move that we take a look at lines 11 through 14.
Well, you probably want to start with 9, where it says political contribution.
Yeah, I suppose.
And what would you like to do? Expand on that?
Yes, I would like to expand them right out of the bill.
Is that a deletion?
I move.
You move to delete lines 9 through 14?
Oh.
Yeah.
On page 1?
On page 1 of the Dash 6 memo.
Do you care to explain this? I think we know.
I think last time.
Well, I sense there will be objections, so maybe the unless there's need for further discussion, the clerk would call the roll on the amendment
to the
Dash 6 amendments, and that is Senator Starr's motion to delete lines 9 through 14 on page 1.
The clerk Senator call Starr's
it? No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Mr. Wilde?
No.
Mr. Miller?
Votes no. All right. We still have before us the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2947. Chair would move, or has moved, the Dash 6 amendments. Is there additional discussion?
Sure.
Senator Byron?
I would move that the Dash 6 amendments be tabled.
Hey. All right. Clerk will call a roll on Senator Byers' motion to table the Dash 6 amendment.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Wilde?
No.
Vice Chair
Wilde?
No.
Chair Miller?
Votes no. Dash 6 amendments are still before us. is there more discussion? If not, the clerk will call a roll on the Dash 6 amendments to my sense of disagreement.
Normal.
You guys are not usually linked up like that.
Senator Beyer.
That would be a no.
Senator Hardison.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilde.
Aye.
Vote aye. House bill, or no, that's it's now before us in its amended version. There's something, okay. Chair would move House bill.
How about the Dash 3?
The Dash 3, oops.
Actually, the
Dash 2.
We're in the Dash.
Actually, 4 amendments are the ones we had talked about, which remove references to all of the credits in the bill except for the moribund.
Oh, yeah.
On the three that show up on
moribund.
Moribund.
Oh, jeez.
Is this like Christmas Tree Titanic?
So by adopting the Dash 8 4 amendments, the only...
The ones that had an impact remain and the zeros are out.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's correct.
The ones that would be removed from statute are the Youth Apprenticeship Sponsorship Credit, the Oregon Capital Corporation Investment Credit, and the Fish Cleaning Credit.
Oh, the fish cleaning would be going.
Oh, green.
Greening.
Yeah.
That's fish cleaning.
Well,
that was the original bill.
That happened. All right, the chair would move the adoption of the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2947. Their discussion,
objection to the amendments. That's the, those that had zero impact and the credits.
Don't we have to reconsider the vote on which we just passed this bill?
That was just that.
You're doing well.
This is an additional amendment to the bill. Let's take care of the discussion yesterday. Those that had zero impact were removing from the statute. Those that had a small amount. If there's no objection, then the amendment is agreed to. Chair would now move House Bill 2947 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Probably actually worth moving to table.
Well, if you want to vote till 10 o'clock. All right, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Kyle?
No.
Senator Hardstein?
Aye.
Senator Wilde?
Aye.
Senator Miller?
Vote aye. House Bill 2947 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session. House Bill 2947. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for all your fine work. Okay. I suppose, as long as we don't get any objections from bias.
I don't think I want to carry that one.
Right? No, I just
thought
okay. I'd
see. Minority report, but I don't
if you second, I was waiting for that.
Second, we'll put the other one on the floor.
Good luck in reconsidering the vote.
Yeah.
All right, now I'll move to a house or a public hearing, House Bill 2139. Elizabeth is that. 2139, let me advise the members that this bill, and I'm sure you've all heard from your many friends about the virtues of this bill. You'll have essentially two choices today before another motion. And I would tell the witnesses that just so that we can consolidate matters. Well, the chair would have an amendment that would keep things going as they are presently operating. The House bill changed current operations significantly. Those are your choices. The additional choice, unless, of course, you want to do whatever you want. Beyond that, this bill is going to Ways and Means.
Going to Ways and Means,
yeah.
Regardless of time.
You'll have a subsequent referral, no matter what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm, Elizabeth?
Okay.
Senator Starr?
Would like to see the change made as in the
president,
as
in that?
As in the House version.
Or to retain the current operation?
Oh, so.
Or to reflect the House changes?
Reflect the House changes.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, when we get into a work session, you'll have that opportunity.
Yeah. Chairman Miller and members of the committee, maybe what I'll start out doing is just making sure we're all on the same page and understanding what the current law is and then what the A and growth does and then what these two amendments, how they're changing it. So to begin with, I have this handout here that starts in with assessment and taxation fund. And what this is, it just gives you, there are currently two sources of assessor funding. And the first one is delinquent interest. And we currently have a 16% interest rate on delinquent taxpayers. And there 4% of that delinquent interest goes into this county assessment fund. But this is going to be sunsetting in July 1st of 2000. And an additional 4% of the remaining 12% of the cities and special districts also goes to that county assessment fund. Now, if this is sunsetted and that sunset is allowed to stand, we're going to have a delinquent interest rate then of 12%. Now, there is the second source of the funding for assessor for this A&T fund is a $20 fee placed on the recording and filing documents which convey or contract to convey any estate or interest in real property. Now, this is a subset of a larger number of documents, and in 1997-98, there were approximately 183,000 documents statewide which paid this $20 fee. And again, this has a sunset of July 1st of 2000. Now, what House Bill 2139 does is that in the A and growth, which came out of the House, we are incorporating the rate to be 1.33% interest without a sunset, so there'll be a 16% annual interest into the permanent statute, and then you still have the same amount of 4% of the first 4% will be going to the A&T fund, as well as the cities and counties additional, cities and special districts additional 4%. Then it is applying a fee of $11 will be charged and collected over a larger number of documents. And the difference in these documents, the majority of them are like mortgage and trust deed type documents, but there's a whole list of them, and you can see that kind of aspect, and there'll be more testimony to the different types of documents in this larger base. Just so you're your understanding. We currently have a base of only about 200,000 documents. We're going to be expanding it in the AIM growth to over 1 million documents. And the growth rate on this larger base is much higher than the growth rate on the smaller amount of documents due to these mortgages and deeds, which fluctuate a lot due to the interest rate and growing quite rapidly due to the low interest recently. So that's your source. And then with your AIM growth, what you also have is a dollar fee that is placed in addition to, you have a $11 fee on the recording documents. And a dollar of that is going to a mapping system, and Jim and Mary will give testimony to what that mapping system is doing. But that's another component of the AIM growth, is a mapping system and an advisory committee and everything. They'll be working with the Department of Revenue on developing that. And then you also, in the AIM growth, you have a study that will be conducted by the Department of Revenue and county governing body and county assessors, and trying to look at possible funding options and the appropriate level for funding the property tax system, and they'll report to the next legislature in 2004. So the AIM growth bill is going to generate more money for the AMT fund. It's currently only generating about $14 million a year, and then this is going to be an additional about $11 million a year, $12 million a year and over the next two bienniums will be approximately $41.6 million, and that's with the current AIM growth bill. Now, with your dash A22 and you have an A23, now the difference between those two is that the A22 is leaving the interest rate so that it will be 16%, and it's leaving that statute and that part of the AIM growth unchanged. And then it is allowing this fee to be $3, which would be approximate the amount that would need in order to generate just the same amount of money that the fund currently is giving, or same amount of money that is generated under current law. But again, there's going to be a slight increase just due to the fact that we've moved to a larger base. This larger base of documents is growing at a faster rate than this smaller basis. And so you have an increase of about $1.2 million from the A22 amendment. But again, the A22 is leaving the interest rate the same. It's eliminating the mapping system that the Department of Revenue will talk about. And it's putting on a $3 recording fee instead of an $11 recording fee. And then the dash A23, what this is doing is it's allowing a sunset of the interest rate. So it'll be going from 16% down to 12%. Now, this adds a little more ambiguity as far as what would need to be the recording fee in order to generate the same amount of money. So what I did is I gave you two different estimates here on this sheet. This is revenue impacts of up to 2139-A22 and A23. I gave you just a table of numbers for you. But basically, I looked at a recording fee of $5 and $6 and how much it would generate. And basically, you're going to need a rate somewhere in between $5 and $6 to get at a complete revenue neutral situation for the first year. But I just realized over the long run, this is not really revenue neutral. It is going to be generating more money for the A&T fund just because this larger base of documents is growing at a faster rate than the smaller rate of documents. So just kind of as a rough estimate, there's a reduction. If you have this interest rate drop from 16% to 12%, reduction of I estimated approximately $3 million a year. So then you're going to have to add approximately a dollar more of the recording fee will generate about $1 million more in revenue. So you're going to have to increase this fee from $3 to like $6 in order to have a positive to have a net change that would be positive. Because if you put on a $5 recording fee in year 1999-2000, you would have the counties would be getting less funds than they currently do under current law. With a $5 fee or a $6 fee, you would be generating just right about $300,000 more. So with the dash A23, just so you're clear, there are blanks in there. So you guys need to decide which level of the recording fee you want to place it at, and then we'll put that in the appropriate place.
All right. Thank you, Lizbeth. Mr. Maneri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I will give you a rather abbreviated version of the summary of the process that led up to the bill, and that is Oregon's property tax system is created and the policy set by the legislature. It's a statewide system and has been since the beginning. As a part of that system, you have required the counties to operate a significant amount of the administration for a lot of the local valuation and taxation part of it. In 1989, you created this funding mechanism that's being discussed, and that was as a part of the recession of the 1980s. Up until 89, you required the counties out of their general fund to pay for their part of the administration of the system. The counties faced significant financial problems in the recession, and had to make severe cuts of all services they provided, including administration of the system. The legislature's response in 89 was to provide a source of funding to reduce the county's financial requirements to run the system, and it basically covered about 20% of the operations of the county, so that the this funding source picked up 20% and the county general fund picked up 80%. You changed that balance a little. That funding continued under a number of sunsets, and in the last session in 97, you continued the funding for two more years, and then directed the Department of Revenue to put together a group to see if we could come up with a permanent source of funding that satisfied all the parties. We put together a group in the interim that included the realtors, the manufactured housing people, the building industry. For the bankers, Frank Barnes started with us and unfortunately retired last year. And in that transition, the bankers weren't able to provide a player for us. And we would hope they could, but it didn't work out that way. Gary Carlson from Associated Oregon Industries and some of his members, though they aren't directly impacted, helped us with the group. And then we had the counties, the cities, the special districts, and the schools. The process took over for at least 12 meetings, different kinds of meetings discussing this. And as a result, we came out with, the group came out with some recommendations on the funding. There were some disagreements, and we brought those into the House Revenue Committee. And the committee then worked on the bill through a number of comprehensive hearings, and House Bill 2139 is a part of that product. I might say the group in the interim really was asked to focus on two things. One is the kind of funding that should be used to support the system, and the second one was us to recognize any efficiencies that might be there in running the new Measure 50 system. We looked at a number of them, and out of the efficiency studies, one of the primary ones came was trying to accelerate the creation of a statewide mapping system that is, at this point, on a county-by-county basis. I will. I was going to show you some overheads, but I won't. I will just tell you in terms of the mapping system, the mapping technology and software for computers has advanced so drastically that not only can you now, out of the computer system, simply draw an accurate map, but you can fold in all kinds of databases into that map to provide a very powerful tool for strategic planning and other uses. This has attracted a lot of interest out of both government and the private sector, and it has a great potential. For that reason, on the House side, they put in a dollar for dedication of the processing fee for the department to work with both the public and private sector to accelerate a mapping base in the state as an advantage for both public and private sector as a tool. Out of the House Revenue Committee, the bill that you have, House Bill 2139A, is, I would say, a product of compromise. There were, as you can see, where you are now in amendments, quite a few amendments trying to get to that. As Elizabeth suggested, what fundamentally is in the bill now is continuing the interest rate, delinquent interest funding that was created in 1989 by the legislature. It changes, again, that document processing fee, which fundamentally covered documents that transferred ownership is really what it does, and it's primarily in the real estate transactions that occurs, and that was at a $20 per document fee. It broadened the base of those documents and that were subject to the fee and dropped the rate. So it dropped the rate in half from 20 to 10, and then it added the dollar. And that in there is the processing fee component. And then the third part, as Elizabeth mentioned, is also for the department again within the next 5 years to put together an interim study with all the players again to see whether the system is running well or whether there's some suggestions for change or even making further efficiencies in the system. And that pretty much covers the summary.
Questions? Senator Beyer.
Jim, the fee is per document, $11 per document, or per page or length of document?
Mr. Senator Beyer, no, it's a per document charge that you do from the clerk's office as a fee for clerks, I believe, runs $5 a page. But this is per document.
This just affects the real estate side.
Yes, this is a separate fee, and it is on a per document basis.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Commissioner Lindley? That would be wonderful.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Bill Riddell, staff of the Association of Oregon Counties. With me is Commissioner Don Lindley from Lincoln County, immediate past president of the association, and Jerry Hansen, who is the director of assessment and taxation for Washington County. And Commissioner Lindley can start off with our fairly brief comments.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us today. I will try not to repeat Mr. McNary's comments. 2139 really moves, as he indicated, the legislative policy direction that was created during the last session in House Bill 2049 and moves us closer to a user-pay system among the taxing districts and the commercial interests which rely on our data, our mapping and records and other information. Mr. Maneri indicated that counties currently pay 80% of local property tax administration costs. 2139 would move us to about 65%. Counties currently only receive about 20% of that revenue that's generated. The system is much different today than when we received it. It's obvious that new sources were needed even back a decade ago in 1989 when this funding program was started. Column Measure 5 added one layer of complexity, which is still in effect. Ballot Measure 50 added another layer of requirements. And these measures also limited our discretionary revenue for this service. While we are facing strong and increased demands for public safety, human services, and many other local services. As a result of these restrictions, for example, in Lincoln County, we have fewer employees today than we had when this program was initiated 10 years ago. Yet we have many more demands for services on our local government than we had then. as a result of Measure 50, we cut nearly half of our appraisers in the assessor's office. And we've gone through our budget process. We've identified our budget. If this source was reduced, we would have some very difficult decisions to make about dollars that would go into the assessor's office or dollars that would go for sheriff deputies or health clinics. We had to cut about $1 million to get to balancing our budget as it was. And there are many other counties that are in very similar kinds of condition. We worked very hard during the interim and, as Mr. Maneri indicated, with all of the players, as many as we could. And we worked very hard in the House to find an acceptable compromise. Counties agreed to a permanent preemption of real estate transfer taxes as a part of that compromise by local government, and we reduced significantly the amount of the recording fee. The final vote in the House was 38-19, and we've been told that many of those who voted no did so because of the preemption of the local taxing authority that it provided local government. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jerry Hansen, I'm an assessor in Washington County, and I have a lot of thoughts on this. We've worked hard on this bill. It's a very important bill to the assessors and to the county. I'll try to briefly state them in 3 points. One, this is an important system. It's $5 billion of biennium in terms of support to 1,500 taxing districts and the school system. $2.2 billion to the school system in a biennium. I would note that the Legislative Revenue Office recently estimated another $46 million for next biennium in terms of contribution from local property taxes for the school system. That reflects a lot of work by appraisers in the field. New construction is the main reason for that, and we're doing that with less staff, and this is a very important bill. We have a partnership in the state of Oregon. We have at the local level doing the work of the counties, the legislature setting the policy, and the Department of Revenue supervising the system. And this funding bill is the glue that keeps that all working. There is a part of the bill that has been discussed quite a bit, and that is the fee on documents. And the reason that's in there reflects, I think, the reality that there are a lot of benefits that inure to private industry, that especially industry relating to real estate. Documents represent folks using our maps, using ownership information, and using appraisal information on a daily basis, and we maintain that system at a great expense. And although it's there to assure that taxpayers are treated fairly and that districts receive their taxes, it also provides a great benefit to private industry. So we believe the fee on documents is definitely justified. Finally, I would mention that we have over time developed a number of efficiencies to make this system work better. In 1980, we had about 1,300 people working at the local level in terms of appraisers and folks at the counter and so forth. Now it's down to about 1,900. We're doing what we've always done, and with more, we have more accounts, and we have Measure 50 as kind of an additional layer of things to administer. And what I would mention about that is that's because primarily we've invested a lot in computerization and changing our systems to keep up with a modern approach. And that does not come without a significant amount of assurance. And one of those assurances has been this funding bill. So I think it's very important that we maintain this and increase the funding to reflect the importance of the property tax system for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Chairman, just available to answer questions.
All right. Thank you all. We've got some additional witnesses.
Thank you.
Mr. Markey. Martinez.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mr. Marquis, on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association and the Oregon Collectors Association, Mr. Martinez is with me representing the Oregon Bankers Association. We are here today opposed to House Bill 2139 in its present form. We would support the Chair's Dash 24 amendments, which would continue the present law as it exists today. We did testify in the House, and we have spoke with the counties. I want to give you a little background. I wasn't party to any of the negotiations that went on in 1989, but I did speak with Mr. Bronner regarding those negotiations because he was involved with them. And he tells me, and he couldn't be here today, but he did give us a statement in writing about those negotiations, and I'll provide copies of that to the committee for the record. But his recollection is that this $20 surcharge that was enacted in 1989 was enacted as a temporary measure to help the counties get their assessments up to fair market value. And in exchange for that, there was a moratorium placed on real estate transfer tax at the local level, and the law was to go away. And it didn't sunset when it was supposed to, then the sunset was extended, and now the current law would sunset next year. I want to make clear that this $20 surcharge that is presently charged on a limited number of documents generates about $3 million a year. And it is charged on those documents that convey an interest in real property, thus the relationship to the moratorium on the real estate transfer tax. The counties have asked for this. Originally, they asked for this $20 fee to be extended to all documents that need to be recorded with the county. And they presented in the House, and I don't know if you got copies of this, but this is like a 22 or 23-page document that lists all of the documents that have to be recorded. And people don't have a choice about that. These things have to be recorded, generally. And so this surcharge would then apply to all of those documents. From death certificates to you name it. Many of these documents have no relationship, in my view, to the assessment and taxation program. In addition to this $20 surcharge, there is presently a $5 per page filing fee or recording fee that is paid for every document recorded with every county. That, in essence, is the processing fee. And I hear this $20 surcharge referred to as a processing fee. I don't agree with that. I think it's a surcharge. There is another surcharge allowed by statute for the Public Land Corner Preservation Fund. And counties are allowed to charge up to $10 on each document filed or recorded, with the county clerk to help county surveyors maintain and restore land corners that are needed for surveys, and it's a laudable program, but Clackamas County, for instance, is at the $10. There are other counties that are at lower rates. So in Clackamas County, you pay $5 per page to file a document. Then on most of those documents, about 80% of them, you pay a $10 surcharge for this land corner preservation fund. And then another $20 if it is a document that conveys interest in a real property, and if this bill passes, it won't be a $20 surcharge, it'll be an $11 surcharge, but it would be on all documents. There's another bill in this building that's in the House, hasn't gotten over here yet, but it would extend the $10 land corner preservation surcharge to all documents. So there was another proposal in the House, hasn't gotten over here, and probably won't in all fairness, but it had another $5 surcharge on all documents recorded with the county clerk with the money dedicated to low-income housing. Again, a laudable cause, but suddenly our clients are looking at a one-page document that costs $5 today that none of these surcharges apply to could cost $40. Now, that won't be the case because most of that won't pass, but if you create another surcharge that applies to all documents, I guarantee that at whatever level it is enacted, we will be looking at an increase, if not next session, the session after, and these will continue to rise. Now, our clients who loan money on houses to people who have saved up for the down payment and all of that, those people, we will have to pass this along to those folks. And on a normal mortgage, it's not one document you're looking at. It's three or four or five. And on many commercial transactions, it can be 20 or 25 documents that this surcharge would apply to. We feel that it's not in the best public interest. Again, the assessment and taxation programs, we want the counties to do those. We want them to do well, and generally speaking, we support them. But we don't think this is the way to fund those programs. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Question, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, is it of interest to your clients to be able to have a title insurance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, of course it is, as it is to anyone who borrows money for a home or any other citizen.
Is it of interest to your clients when they're making real estate loans to be able to check and make sure that the property is correct and doesn't have any liens against it?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm glad you asked that, because this surcharge and the other surcharges that are being expanded to all documents would have to be paid when you file a satisfaction on a lien. And what part of our concern is, we encourage people to file satisfactions because they ought to get off the books so that you're not chasing down somebody that for a lien that has already been paid. The court system in this state, judgments become an automatic lien against real property when they're entered in the docket, but those when you file a satisfaction with the court, there's no fee for it, none. Not even a filing fee, a processing fee, no surcharge, no nothing. It's a zero cost because the courts learned a long time ago that it's better to encourage people to file satisfactions, and that gets the liens off the books, and then we don't have to hassle with them if they've already been paid. This surcharge applies to satisfactions. We think that in the other bill would expand the $10 fee to satisfactions. We think that's bad policy because the higher you raise that price to file a satisfaction, the fewer people that are going to file.
So would we be better off if we didn't have the recording function at all?
No, I think that Senator Beyer, I think that we should have that function. I'm suggesting to you that this is not the way to pay for it.
Do you have another suggestion?
Well, the current law generates $3 million a year. The rest is funded out of the county general fund. County assessment and taxation programs generally have been funded mostly out of county general fund and other, there are some supplementary things in this bill. I have seen no evidence presented by the counties or anyone else, either in this body or the other body, that indicates to me an inability to fund those programs at the current level, under current law. I simply haven't seen that evidence. I've heard people say that they can't do it.
I guess I can only respond to the one in the county that I live in and know best. And I know that we're down to the point of having three sheriffs on patrol in the evenings, at least. And I know the fact that we have a district attorney that has made the decision that he can only prosecute felony cases because he doesn't have the ability. The county isn't able to give him the money to do anything else. And I'm sympathetic, and I'm sincerely, I just, down to the end, after Measure 5 and Measure 50, I'm short of imposing an income tax that they haven't done. I think counties are in a position of trying to figure out how to fund these services, and I seriously, in fact, the discussion I've suggested at many times is, why don't you just give it back to the state? If you can't fund it, this certainly, in my opinion, is not at the same level as maintaining the law enforcement system. It's convenience for the public and the real estate. It's a convenience for us to do transactions, but I think we're we're battling the issue of how to fund it, and I haven't heard of any good suggestions other than this one that's come forth. It's not, I don't think it's necessarily a favored way to do it. I just haven't heard of another way to do it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, and these programs need to be funded. There's no question about that, and I don't disagree with that. But I believe when somebody comes to the legislature and takes a tax, which this surcharge is, it's a tax on people who record documents, that generates about $3 million a year today, and increases that amount, the amount taken, by 400 or 500%, then they ought to present evidence exactly where that money is going. And frankly, I have never seen this money all flows to the Department of Revenue. And then it's redistributed back to the counties, but not necessarily to the counties where it was generated. You may have more recordings in Lane County, but they have more of a need for assessment and taxation money in a different county. And that money gets redistributed under this plan. And we think that's wrong.
Thank you. Ms. Martinez, you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in deference to the hour, I'll be very brief and would just associate really my remarks with Mr. Marquis. I would agree with the Department of Revenue earlier in that we were invited to participate in this work group, but due to the retirement of Mr. Bronner and the subsequent hiring of his replacement and then myself as the government affairs representative, we never really had a chance to participate in the study. As you know, bankers are a very conservative group. We're very comfortable with continuing the $20 on the small number of documents. We get very nervous when we look at the 22 pages that Mr. Marquis presented, even though there are a lot of those that we're not involved in, but dropping that to $11 as they did in the House when they started at 20 leads us to believe that they'll be back sooner rather than later to raise it again and try to get it back to the 20, if not higher, down the road. So we're comfortable with where we're at. We've had 10 years of experience. As Mr. Marquis mentioned, when this happened in 89, we were told it was going to sunset at some point. Clearly, that's not going to happen because of the intervening actions of the voters. But again, we don't look at the chair's amendments, the Dash A24s, as a reduction. It's going to leave everything where it's at as far as the money that's coming in, and we'll support that. I would just close by saying that Mr. Marquis, through the mortgage bankers, and myself through the Bankers Association, are part of the United Financial Lobby, which includes the credit unions, the consumer finance groups, the mortgage brokers, and we're all in support of the chair's amendments and opposed to the bill as you have it before you today.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. We'll call up Lynn McNamara. League of Oregon Cities. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. The League swallowed hard and supported and still supports 2139 as it was passed by the House. There are a couple things that we didn't like about it, and I'd just like to tell you about those briefly and just raise an issue that has come up today with the A23 amendments should you choose to go in that direction. The League is opposed to the inclusion of a real estate transfer tax preemption in the bill. We don't believe that local jurisdictions should be preempted from any revenue-raising sources. And in my personal experience, I sold a house in another state. Before I moved here, I paid over $800 as a real estate transfer tax to that state and the city that I lived in. That's a real estate transfer tax. I bought a house in Oregon a couple of weeks ago. The $60 filing fee was by far the smallest number on my closing statement.
Could I ask you a question? Did that state have a sales tax?
It did.
I'm not surprised. Thank you.
Okay. So we oppose the real estate transfer tax preemption, and we are also concerned that the bill, as it went forward, continued the additional amount of delinquent interest that cities and special districts pay toward the program. But because that the fees were being expanded to a larger number of documents, private sector individuals were picking up more of the a cost we did not pose it. So we support 2139 as it came before you. The 823 amendments, if the amount of interest charged on delinquent taxes is to be reduced, we would be concerned if the language remains in the bill that says 25% of the interest comes off the top and goes to ANTI, and then cities and special districts pay another 25%. That would actually take revenue away from cities in a way that it does not now. Again, we don't mind supporting the ANTI program to the extent that we do now, but we do not think that cities should be giving up more of its services to support the ANP program, so that if you do go in the direction of the A23s, we would ask that you take that into consideration and further amend the bill to not have cities pay more than the proportions that we are paying now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Personally, I do not know what the chair wishes to do at this time, because I would guess we... Oh, would you like to come up? Terry Schmitz of the Oregon Realtors.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today supporting Senate Bill, House Bill 2139A. You're getting the second string. Jenna Ingram is in Washington, D.C., and I'm sorry, she's probably a little bit more efficient at this discussion than I am, but I can kind of give you a capsulization here of where the realtors are coming on this issue. As you heard from earlier testimony, some of the money that's being generated goes back into the general fund. We're definitely opposed to the issue of having a certain small segment of these of our state pay for general fund type things like police and fire and other general fund type activities. So that's why we're supporting the philosophy of spreading it to all documents, not just a certain portion of our society. We did participate in the interim, along with the builders and the manufactured housing and other groups. I am here issuing the support along with the support of the home builders and the support of the manufactured housing industry. Our concern is that we do want this program to continue, and if it is continued, we want it spread out to the documents, all affected documents, not just a small proportion. So that's where we're coming from. In my testimony, I kind of went into some more of the specifics. We don't have a position on whether the fee is 18, 20, 5, 4. That's you folks to decide. But our issue is that by spreading out those documents, I think you give a little bit of fairness to this issue, and of course we do support the moratorium on real estate transfer taxes.
I'd like to ask you on the A22s and A23 amendments, there is the provision, or possibly in the bill as a whole as well, the provision that if the recording fee is less than $11, then the moratorium on real estate transfer tax does not apply. How would you feel?
We would be opposed to the bill along with the home builders and along with the manufactured housing folks.
Wanted to get that on the record?
Yes.
And look who comes back just in time.
Just in time.
Helping create a quorum in the next room. So,
aha.
Appreciate your indulgence. The witnesses, have you completed your testimony?
I have, Mr. Chair.
All right. And all those... Lynn McNamara spoke. I noticed the distinguished Commissioner Soa is here. Did you wish to testify, Commissioner?
I just came to make sure that...
Uh-oh. That's enough said.
I just came to make sure that Commissioner
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Sure.
Was there anyone else who wished to testify? If not, then we'll close the public hearing, unless you already had, on House Bill 2139. Open a work session on House Bill 2139. And the chair would move the dash 24 amendments to House Bill 2139.
Can we talk about it? Yeah,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, just so you're understanding what the A24 says, the 24s are keeping the status quo in the sense that it will keep the $20 fee on the smaller number of documents. So it will not expand the base. It'll just keep it on the smaller number of documents. It's going to delete all the mapping aspects that is in the bill. It is keeping the interim study on the A&T funding. In Section 10, it is retaining the 16% interest, and it is keeping the $20 fee, and it will not be sunsetted. It's keeping the moratorium on the real estate transfer tax in at $11.
All right.
Okay, and just in case you're interested, there is another. I did happen to give you a page here on the annual amount of money generated and projected for the assessment and taxation fund under current law. So if you want to see this as far as how much is currently being generated, then you can see that from 1991 to 2003.
Okay. We have the dash 24s before us. Is there... There may be objections, so we'll, why don't we just call the roll.
Senator Hartung?
No.
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Vice Chair Wild?
Aye.
Chair Miller?
That sounds trouble. It'd be exciting. But by the motion has failed. Are there other amendments that the members wish to pursue? I don't. All of the other ones have a real estate transfer tax exempt for the ability to have one if you stay below 11.
Thus, we have
just so long
23s with the blanks.
Just so long as everyone's clear here, this real estate transfer, this is in Section 6. This is not changed.
Right, I understand.
Yeah, it's always in there.
That's worded with it in.
Okay.
The bridge there. So. And the Senator Starr.
I would move the bill without further amendment.
All right. Senator Starr moves House Bill 2139 to the floor, or no, to a subsequent, it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senator Starr moves House Bill 2139 as it is before us to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion. Senator Hartung.
Could someone explain the necessity going to Ways and Means and why it didn't go there before it came to us, if it is necessary. Mr. Maneri, could he explain that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I can't explain that out of necessity there is a fiscal impact, and that is because this funding funds about 30 positions in the department. There are other fund positions, so they disappear halfway through the next biennium because the funding source ends under current law. So it would be necessary for either Ways or Means or the Emergency Board, which is what we did last time, to give us back the position authority if the funding source, if a funding source continues for it.
Okay, that was correct. Senator Beyer.
I guess it's an advantage if we're going to Ways and Means, is if they choose to have multiple problems with this. Certainly would be within Ways and Means power just to make an appropriation out of the general fund.
Yeah. And I suppose if they wanted some changes in policy, they could send it back to us.
Or to whatever committee is open.
Yeah. Always dangerous rules.
That's for sure.
All right, is there discussion on the motion If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Bartow.
Aye.
Aye.
Dr. Wells.
No.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 2139 is moved to the Ways and Means Committee. We'll close the public, or the work session, excuse me, on House Bill 2139. We now have one other bill before us, and we'll have just a very brief hearing. Hopefully, I would like to hear the principal proponent have his opportunity, and I apologize to him for not having us on sooner today. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your bill.
Yep. And I put this bill in last session, and it went to a committee where they just had a whole lot of work to do. And I will put it on the record that it's probably the only bill I've ever submitted that Senator Bryant said he actually liked. So that's a first. But I just look at fairness. I mean, we are the government. We determine people's penalties. We determine how much interest they have to pay when they're past due. We determine those things. The people don't necessarily have a tremendous amount to say in that unless they want to put together an initiative, and it would be very difficult to do on that sort of thing. And so in my opinion, there's a necessity to be fair. And at this time, personally, with interest rates at what they are, I personally do not think anything in excess of 9% is fair. That is my opinion. And so what I went through with legislative counsel was pick out all of the different areas. Because I'll tell you, our statute is written, it's very good for attorneys and tax accountants and that sort of thing. Because in each little nook and cranny, we've got a different interest. We've got, everything is different. So you have to go research all of it. And what I would like is a central section in statute that simply states interest amount, that if you want to go and change interest rates for things because times have changed, that you can go to one central area and change that, and it will change throughout statute. And so that is what I tried to do, kind of have this one central point that you change your interest rate at, then spreads out and changes all of the other areas. So you don't have to go through every chapter of statute. If, say, inflation rates get up to 16%, obviously 9% is not in order, and the legislature probably would bump that up significantly. But they wouldn't have to have bills going through each and every chapter of statute. They could go to the 9% and say, okay, 16% is now appropriate.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Senator Wells?
Yeah, I guess I would have two. Senator, what would you, I'm trying to figure out how this would work in situations where a small municipality that might be doing, improvement bonds or something like that, and and not being highly rated, they make it very expensive rates and could not even offer the bonds at a 9% rate. They may have to borrow more than that.
If you look at the different parts of statute it impacts, what we tried to do was go through the areas that would not be involved in a contractual relationship, say, where you...
Those are exempted under the bill?
If you look through, we picked out specific sections of statute. We did not wholesale deal with all parts of statute because I was working toward one... Obviously, contract. You have to go with what's available. But once again, that's even more what government pays in interest. It is not what they charge in terms of fees and assessments and penalties and past due, that sort of thing. I more was gearing myself toward what we take in, as opposed to what we pay out. Because you see, when I go into contractual relationship, say I want to put in a sewer, that is, as a government, what I am paying out to a contractor or to investors, actually, in order to gain the funds to do the project. That was not nearly so much the target of this. And in some cases, I did deal with that, but in very few. It was much more a matter of, well, as I said, penalties, that sort of thing, such as on real estate. If you're past due 16%, I'm sorry, regardless of what the funds are used for, that's usurious. And I do not think it's acceptable for government to charge that percent. And under this, that would be 9%. That is my philosophy, and that's what I want to bring forward. I think it's a fair interest rate. It is not exceptionally low, and yet it's not exceptionally high. And very easy to change in terms of statute if you desire. Now, it was brought to me, perhaps you should have it tied to some kind of prime rate or some other thing such as that. Well, that makes it difficult because if you change quarterly, annually, a lot of people anticipate things and they make decisions based on that. And if you have this rolling average, it makes it difficult. And that's why, say, you go with a variable interest rate on something, in terms of a mortgage, say, you'll get it at a lower interest rate because you just don't know what's going to happen. There's more inherent risk in dealing with that vehicle. Whereas if you go with something fixed, you generally have to pay a higher interest rate because you have reasonable expectation for a longer period of time. And so I personally did not want to go with a rolling interest rate where no one would know 6 months out what it would be. There would have to be reflection and decision made on any changes and taking the current times into context and then making an adjustment based on that. I mean, if we go down to a steady 1% inflation, which I don't believe will happen, but if we did, obviously 9% is rather excessive. So anyway, I just wanted to throw it out there.
Well, here's what the chair would propose, and I'm to note that Mr. Warner has gone through and found some of the interest rates of different agencies.
Yes, Mr. Chair, from Legislative Fiscal Survey, the statutes and the agencies, and I've talked to a number of them myself, and really confirmed the Senator Wild's conclusion that there are interest rates throughout the statutes affecting a large number of programs and a number of different agencies. The major impact that we were able to isolate in terms of revenue was the interest on delinquent property taxes, which would have a revenue impact if it was to go from current 16% to 9%. That would reduce revenue from that source by about $16 million per year based on collections from delinquent payments over the last year.
How much?
About $16 million per year, $33 million for the biennium. Those are revenues that go spread throughout the property tax system, so they're primarily local government and schools.
I do note on your list there, there are some that apparently charge credit card interest. Employment Department, 18%.
Wow.
Water control.
Those are rates in which there are statutory authorities to go that high.
So oh, I see.
It doesn't necessarily mean that those agencies are charging those rates. They have the statutory authority to go that high.
You'd probably hear about it if they did. Office of Energy, 18% authority. Well, here's what I do, and I want to apologize to the witnesses who are here. Unless they have something very brief, Mangus, all right, because we have run over our time, and I promised this committee we wouldn't have a Friday meeting, and if we keep going, we will. So if it's convenient for you to give just a very brief statement, that would be fine. What I would do is I would tell you that when the Senate President gave me the hook, I have the strong indication we will be back together at some point. And I may ask him to see if we can put this on our schedule at that time and have further discussion, and I would invite those who are have an interest in this bill one way or another, communicate to us your feelings, and that'll help us decide whether or not this matter reappears. Mr. Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Mangus, Director of Department of Veterans Affairs. I passed out some written testimony. I'll keep it short. I just wanted to express our concern. The drafting of the bill, they did take time to look at Chapter 407, which is the basic loan program, but we do have questions about other programs that exist in under Article 11A of the Constitution that would have an ability of us to be able to service our debt that we have outstanding, matching our debt with guaranteed investment contracts with for our variable rate debt. And then we have a number of other programs in Chapter 406, 408 that we have to earn at the highest rate possible because that money is shared with individuals under a conservatorship program, or it's the Veterans Home Trust Fund, which that money is again used to help with the operation of the Veterans Home. I have it down here in the testimony. I won't take any more of your time, but we do have a concern.
Well, that's what I'd suggest. And there are other witnesses here, all of whom are around here on a fairly regular basis. If you have concern, I would invite you to express them to the sponsor directly and see if something can be resolved. And if it can't, then we'll determine whether or not we have, as I said, another public hearing, and we'll air the irreconcilable differences and see what happens. But is that all right with the sponsor?
That's what I would prefer.
Thank you. All right. We'll close then the public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Anything further to come before the committee?
So we're setting over 126.
126 was blended into 2947 or whatever.
Oh, that's
that was.
What
we took our.
What did we put that into?
It
became the flip.
It was.
Well, that was the.
Yeah, that was 2947.
That's right.
Yeah, great bill. Good
stuff. That bill.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? I appreciate everybody and the staff staying
good work.
Well beyond our normal time, and
so
thank you all for your work and putting everything together in short order with this long agenda.
You know, I'm missing that
meeting
because of
adjourned.
It.